Welcome to the Living Waters Church Podcast.
If we've yet to meet, my name is Luke. I'm on our pastoral team. And welcome here. Let me add my voice of welcome to the rest of our team. When we were speaking about life groups, we want to let you know about just two more groups that are happening in this area. And it's a group that's being hosted by Dave and Julie, our lead pastor, and myself and my wife, Sarah. These two groups are called welcome groups. So Ruben noted that next week we're going to have welcome meetups. And those follow the services. So if you're new, brand new, you can show up to that, meet a couple of our pastoral team members and others in the community, and ask questions, and we'll do what we can to help. A welcome life group is for folks who've maybe been here for a little while and have yet to connect into a life group. Maybe you've been here for a few months and you're just getting integrated into the church and you'd say, yeah, this is going to be home for me, church-wise. We would love to host you in a welcome life group. They go for about 4 or 5 weeks, and all we do is come together and we share our stories. So you'll hear my story, whether you want to or not, and I'll hear your story. We get time to ask questions about the church, learn a little bit about the values of our congregation, and kind of go from there. It's a great way to connect. And I know I'm looking at many of you in the room who've been through and a part of a welcome life group. And so if you've yet to do that, we'd love to host you in that. And if you want questions or you'd like to sign up for it, you can do it online. You can even come at the end of the service just to the front row here, and Dave and I have some information for you if you want to take it away. The other thing I want to let you know about just before we dig in today is that on October 7th, which is Thanksgiving, Doug Smith is going to be joining us to share. For those of you who don't know Doug, he was the previous lead pastor here, so we're excited to welcome he and Linda. They're going to come and share and say all kinds of nice things to us, because that's just what they do, and they're lovely people. So we're looking forward to having them and hosting them. I encourage you to be here for Thanksgiving weekend for that. Today we're continuing in our series called Neighbor. And in the series, we have endeavored to explore the theme of what it means to be a neighbor by sitting in the parable of the Good Samaritan, which is one of the most, if not the most famous story that Jesus ever told. And the story that he told was born out of what we described last week as a wriggly question. Jesus is having a conversation between himself and a religious expert. And the religious expert asks him, what do I have to do in order to receive eternal life, to know the full abundant life of God right here on earth? And Jesus says, well, what do you think? And the man replies, well, as I would understand it, I need to love God with everything I am, and I need to love my neighbor as myself. And Jesus says, that's right. Off you go. Do it. And then the man pauses and asks that wriggly question. But what do you mean by neighbor? Who is my neighbor? Sort of like a wriggly question that a teenager would ask. If you ask them to clean their room, they might say, well, what do you mean by clean, right? It's a wriggly question. The text says that the man wants to justify his life or justify how he's been living. Jesus then tells the story of the Good Samaritan, which Rachel read for us in between those songs. And to the wriggly question, he gives an unwriggly punchline, gives a devastating punchline. He tells an unexpected story. Effectively, what he tells in that story, when he raises the Samaritan to the position of not the villain, but actually the hero, which is what no one would have expected, he says, if you want in on God's full, abundant life, you're going to have to get used to your lines getting scrubbed out and your walls coming down. And that very much is a part of the whole story that Luke is telling us in his gospel. It's a story of the non-belongers becoming belongers. It's the story of the outsiders becoming the insiders. And we follow Jesus through all of that gospel, going to people and places over and over again where God is not supposed to be, and saying to those people and to those people, and those places, yes, God is here. God is interested. You are not a non-belonger. Through me, you are now actually a belonger. And that is very, very good news. It's good news for you and for me. It's good news for the whole world. It means that when God looked at the world, he didn't wriggle out of love with us. Even those of us who feel that we're on the periphery, those of us who feel that we're way out on the margins, God looks at us and says, I love you. You're not a non-belonger, you're a belonger with me through Jesus. That's really good news. But it's also a challenge for us as God shows us his love, his heart, who he really is, and invites us into that very way of being, the way that he is, as made in his image, as created by him. He says, there's a real, true, beautiful way to be human. But in order to do that, you're going to have to get used to the lines being scrubbed out and the walls being broken down. God says, my life, my love through Jesus is breaking in and on and through all kinds of people in all kinds of places. And so not only do we have to learn to become open-hearted to God as he shows his love to us, but following Jesus means becoming even more open-hearted to others, all kinds of people that we might not expect ourselves to be open-hearted to. And this takes time, and it takes a lot of God's love. And it's probably a journey that will never really end. As long as we breathe, we're going to learn how to receive more of God's love and to allow more of that love to flow through us. And sometimes when we start, it can feel a bit difficult. When I went to study to be a pastor, I found myself living in a dormitory with all kinds of people that I didn't expect to meet. And some of those people were the kinds of people that you would expect to want to go and train and be pastors. They were really smiley. They seemed to just have a perfect-looking life. They're the kinds of people that would walk around just bursting into song like a Disney character. Some of them literally would do that, and it was very annoying, but they did throughout the dorms. And you went, yeah, that person seems like they should probably be in ministry. And then there was others of us. And then there were some people on the other side of that spectrum who didn't seem like they really even wanted to be there. Some of them were there because their parents expected them to go and try it out. And some of them were there because they felt deep inside that they were supposed to be there. They were supposed to be in a place where they would be shaped and be formed. They felt called, but they were reluctant. They were a lot like Jonah. I'll go, but I don't really want to. That kind of an attitude. One of these people was a friend of mine. We were in the same year together, and he was particularly curmudgeon-y. He was not happy about being there. He wouldn't eat with us. He would isolate himself. He would spend time alone, and he grew a gross beard. He was just one of those people who just kind of stayed away and made it look like you should want to stay away from him, that kind of a guy. He took it out kind of the most on his roommate. One day his roommate came home and my friend had taken masking tape and drew a line down the center of the room, you know, like an 8-year-old does, and said, that's your side, this is my side, and that's just the way that it's going to be. The summer finally arrived and my friend went back. He was from Ontario and we all went off to our jobs. The summer went by and we all came back that next fall, and when we were interacting with him in that September, it seemed like he was a little bit different, like things had perhaps shifted a little bit. He was a little bit warmer, he was a little bit brighter, he was a little bit happier, you could say, even a little bit more open-hearted to us. And it was obvious that he had experienced something profound, and that thing that he experienced that was so incredibly deep and profound was not necessarily something that occurred in a church service or in a time of prayer. It was simply that he had met a girl. Which is often the case for men that young age. When you see a massive change, a massive shift, it's probably got to do with someone entering their life they didn't expect. And this particular young woman was gentle and kind and full of love and openness to him. and she began to show him what it might mean to live in a world that was colored that way, to live in a world of openness and kindness and love, and that hardness of heart began to shift in him. Ironically, the girl's name was Faith, and so we used to joke that finally Amos had found his faith, and things began to shift in him in that way. He started to change, but it wasn't dramatic. It took time. And over the years, as he was shaped and formed by that relationship and God's love through that relationship in his own life, he began to look more and more like himself. He began to be more and more open, more and more welcoming, more and more of who we really know he actually wanted to be. But it took time. And it takes us time. It takes time and it takes God's love. What we like to do over the next couple of weeks, as we've listened to the story now for 2 weeks, is to start asking the question, more concretely, what might learning to love our neighbor as ourselves start to look like? What does learning to love your neighbor as yourself really mean? What are some steps that we can take? If we're inspired by Jesus' example and inspired by the love he's called us into, what does it mean to step into more of that love, to become more open-hearted, to become more of the people that he's made us to be? 3 things I'd like to touch on today: stopping, joining, and sharing. Stopping, joining, and sharing. First, stopping. Learning to love your neighbor as yourself, perhaps it begins with stopping. Stopping to look and to listen. Discovering the power of stopping in a rushed and distracted society, just to pay somebody else attention. In his recent pastoral memoir, Eugene Peterson, who wrote a translation of the Bible you might be familiar with called The Message, tells a story about a group of pastors that he would meet with consistently and have lunch together. They would sit down consistently about once a month, and they would just eat a meal together. They would share about what's going on in their lives, in their churches, to be a sort of support network for one another. Well, he tells a story of one time, them gathering, and Peterson noticed out of the corner of his eye in the restaurant a young woman who was in distress, who's clearly just having a difficult time. And so he got up from the table, and he went over to the table and to her table and began to speak with her and ask her if she needed anything. Just tried to be kind, offered to pray, things like that. And after a few moments with that young woman, he came back to the table, and one of the other pastors looked at him in complete bewilderment and said, "I don't know how you do that. I don't have time to do that. I got to run the darn church." If you're like me, you might feel less at times like the saintly Eugene Peterson and a bit more like that pastor. That would be a nice thing to do, to stop and to look and to listen at people around me. But I have things to do. We all have things to do. But there's others who've gone before us, and they've made a strong case by how they live, that getting things done and stopping and paying attention to people are not necessarily opposing forces. They're not necessarily different sides of the equation. I found a quote this week from John Wesley, who helped to found the Methodist movement in England. And one of the things that he said, I found really quite astounding when I heard it. He said this: "Though I am always in haste, I am never in a hurry, because I never undertake any more work than I can go through with perfect calmness of spirit." That's an interesting thought. You might think of John Wesley or a pastor or someone like that as someone who has lots of time on their hands to just sit around thinking and praying. You say, well, that's okay for those people, but what about the rest of us who live in the real world? But we should remember some of the things that John Wesley accomplished in his life. He was absolutely pivotal to prison reform in England at the time, making huge steps in social justice. He was pivotal in helping Great Britain moved towards the abolition of slavery, and he had been visiting the United States and saw the impact on that and got very involved. This was a man of action. This was a man who got things done. But it didn't mean that he wasn't a person of measured consideration, someone who could live a life with perfect calmness of spirit. Maybe it starts with being mindful of how full our plates are. And many of us, we can't do an awful lot about that. We're in a season of our lives, we're in a particular situation, and things are just busy and full. And so the very last thing that we should say to one another is, here's another thing to do. Make sure you stop and pay more attention to people. It's just to say, maybe we should ask the question, does a full and busy life necessarily mean a deeply productive life as God would see it? Should we ask that question? What would it mean to learn to discover the subtle power of making ourselves more available one to the other? That might mean some sacrifice. That might mean some letting go of things that we can let go. But what would it mean to start to discover the subtle power of making ourselves available, of seeing the other with dignity, of seeing another person as worthy of our time, of worthy to be listened to? In many of my conversations with friends over the years, one of the things that we ask one another is, what is God saying to me? Sometimes we say to one another, I'm frustrated because I don't feel like God is speaking. But one of the things that I find myself not thanking God for is the fact that he is listening. It's one of the great gifts that God gives us. Constantly listening, always available, always present for us. And I have to believe that as creatures made in his image, to some extent, that capacity is in us as well. We are made to be available to one another, to stop and to look and to listen. And we might not get that right all the time, and we might not be able to do it constantly. But when we do have a moment, when we do have an opportunity, not just to rush past, but to turn aside, maybe we could begin to take those opportunities, to explore them, and to see what actually comes out of it. Learning to stop and to look and to listen is that one step forward in what it means to understand how to love your neighbor as yourself. Stopping inevitably will lead to joining with compassion and kindness. Joining by saying the person that we're interacting with is not an object to get over, to get past, to get around, to get through, to force to where we want, but actually a person with dignity, worthy of our time, someone that we can actually be open to. And that's what we could call stepping into the togetherness reality. The reality that we are actually all together in this, that we're not all that different. The reality is that we're all one as human beings when it comes to our dignity and our value. But oftentimes we don't dignify one another because we view each other as different. And joining with people, coming alongside people, helps us with that. I know that we're still quite a ways away from Christmas, so I apologize for bringing it up for those of you who are really intense on the Christmas only being in December thing. But as we were working through this text together, it reminded me of a particular story, which is A Christmas Carol from Charles Dickens. And if you have ever read that story or seen that film, you'll remember that there is a scene early on where Scrooge is sitting in his counting house, and we've just been told just how nasty and cold and closed a person he is, but his nephew arrives. His nephew bursts in, and his intent is to wish his uncle just a Merry Christmas and to invite him to dinner. And his nephew says this, "I've always thought of Christmas time as a good time, a kind, forgiving, charitable, pleasant time. The only time I know of in the long calendar of the year when men and women seem, by one consent, to open their shut-up hearts and to think of people below them as if they really were fellow passengers to the grave and not another race of creatures bound on other journeys." It's a helpful phrase that Dickens gives us, fellow passengers. The other is not other than me, so to speak. And that's exactly what we see in the story of the Samaritan. Even though there's division, ethnic and cultural and religious, here we have the Samaritan stopping. Here we have the Samaritan turning to side and the Samaritan joining, getting involved, and starting simply with that. Being with that person who is in that desperate spot. Being with that person who is in need, and simply starting there. And of course, when we'd read the New Testament, when we'd listen to the story and consider the person even telling this story, this is who we have in Jesus Christ. Here is a God who joins us. Here is a God who does things for us, who gives to us, who provides for us, absolutely. But here also is a God who joins us. A God who listens and a God who comes alongside. A God who doesn't simply sit far off and dispense, but a God who joins. And there is a big difference between joining and dispensing. Sometimes we think that the world's problems would be solved if we could just dispense more to one another. We could just get more resources here or there or everywhere, and then everything would be okay. But as one writer says, when we think about people who are in difficult situations, perhaps people who are impoverished, the poor are not a problem to be solved. The poor are a people to be joined. And that very much is what we see in the life of Jesus. Here is a God who joins us and invites us into that kind of adjoining life. There's people in our community that do this very well, and I don't want to embarrass them, but they do sit amongst us. And these are the people in our community that serve in places like the hospice or serve in the Fort Langley's seniors community just down the road. They're the people in our community who understand the power of joining. Some of them are teachers. Some of them are nurses. Some of them are doing that kind of work. They're people that have found themselves in positions, realizing that there's really not an awful lot that they can necessarily dispense. They can't solve the problem. They can't change things. But what they can do is powerful, and that is simply to join, is simply to be with. So I want to encourage you, if you're one of those people in one of those positions, we're so thankful for you. We're so thankful for those of you who serve in our society who join like that, who are willing to roll up your sleeves and to get involved and to just be together with. And at its best, that's in many ways what the church is, modeling Jesus in this joining reality. Joining, not just dispensing. Stopping moves to joining, and inevitably, as we'd understand the life of Jesus, and in the history of the church, it moves to sharing. Sharing through generous service. This is exactly what the Samaritan does in the story. After pulling up the tape in the dorm room, so to speak, the Samaritan realizes that the other is not other than, and that we can actually share what we have. And so the Samaritan cares for this person as they would care for themselves. Goes above and beyond, does everything they can. You'll notice in the story that the Samaritan puts this broken, bleeding person, half dead, on their own donkey. There's a sense of togetherness there that is resoundingly deep and beautiful. But there's also a sense of giving and of sacrifice. We see this, of course, most clearly through Jesus. Jesus who gives generously with a wide open heart and wide open veins. God, flesh and blood amongst us, who gives us all of himself right to the end, right to his death. That's what Jesus tries to get across to his disciples right before he dies, of course. He's about to go to the cross. This is towards the end of the Gospel of John. Jesus intends to describe for his disciples what he's about to do. And so he takes off his outer garment, John tells us, and he washes his disciples' feet. He does what in that culture only a servant or a slave would do. And then he turns to his disciples and he says, If I've done this for you, your Lord, your Master, your example, how much more so should you do this for one another? Go and do this kind of thing. Do what you can. What we see in Jesus in the foot washing is the same thing that we see in Jesus on the cross. Here is a God who pays our bills. Here is a God who cleans up our mess, our dirt. Here is a God who does for us what we can't do for ourselves. And this very much is the kind of life that Jesus invites us into. We're not inexhaustible like God. We can't pour out necessarily like God can, but we can be poured through. We are vessels that he can work through, that he can care through, that he can express through. And so the church at its best is a group of people that pays one another's bills, that serves one another generously, that shares as much as they can, and a group of people that are always open to sharing for others. Sometimes we hear those sorts of things and it can make us a little bit edgy. I don't know. I don't know if I have enough. I don't know if I can give enough. I don't know if I have those kinds of resources within myself. And yet Jesus still calls us into that life. He tempts us into that life. What if you were just to try it? Just to be a little more open. A little more open to me. A little more open to what I might be able to do through you. And we can encourage each other in that as well. That's exactly what's going on in Paul's first letter to the Corinthians. He's planted this church, and he hears about what's going on there, and he sends them a letter. He encourages them, but he also says there's a couple things that they can perhaps grow a little bit in. One of them is that the people in this first Christian community are suing each other. They've somehow had some kind of business interaction that's gone wrong, and so they take their dispute into the public courts. And Paul says, that's not the way to go about it. Isn't there someone amongst you that can help you come to some kind of resolution? But then he says this, even if there isn't someone who can come along and help you guys resolve what's going on, even if that's not possible, wouldn't it just be better for you to incur one another's debt? And to an extent, that's what we're always doing one to the other in Christian community. We're going to let one another down. I'm going to let you down. Dave's going to let you down. Bailey's going to let you down when he gets his name wrong and thinks his name's Lynn. We're all going to let each other down. It's going to happen from time to time. What does it mean when we do that to incur one another's debt, to wash one another's feet, to step into a foot-washing reality, a togetherness reality, a forgiveness reality? Here is a group of people that are willing to, rather than push one another aside, to let one another in, to pay one another's bills. Another situation that's going on in that church in Corinth is that the church is gathering to celebrate the Lord's Supper together. And the way that they did that in that context was they would share a meal and everyone would eat together. And that would mean that the people who have much would help those who have little. But it had gone a little bit backwards in Corinth because they'd get together for these meals and people would show up and eat all of the food before the day laborers who were still out in the fields could come in and get their food. Basically, the poorest people in this church were not being fed because the people who had more time and space, which usually meant they had more money, were eating the food first. Paul says, it shouldn't be this way. And so he simply says this, wait. Just wait. Wait for one another. What does it mean for you and for me in this context, in this community, in this society, to wait for one another, to be patient for one another, to recognize that the other is not other than, and to make sure that everyone's fed? Two things that come out of Corinthians. What would it mean to be a people who are willing to incur one another's debt and a people who are willing to wait for one another? Paul says towards the end of the letter, to a group of Christians who are very interested in being smart and learning things. The Corinthians, we can understand in that reading, pride themselves on their knowledge. Paul says this, rather than being proud of how smart you are, Paul simply says, let your highest goal be love. Let your highest goal be love. Do what you can for each other. So those are some thoughts moving forward as we sit in this story for the rest of this month. Stopping, joining, and sharing. We might go out in today and find ourselves faced with a number of different opportunities where we can stop and we can join and we can share. But we can actually begin to do that right now in this gathering, one to the other. The way that we're told we can do that as Christians, the way that's modeled throughout the New Testament, is that it actually begins with prayer. Prayer is where we begin to stop. Prayer is where we begin to join with one another as we remember a God who joins with us. And prayer is a place where we share with one another. I'm going to invite the team to come on up. And we're going to spend some time just stopping, just joining, and just sharing. You might be here today, and this is an opportunity for you to finally stop. And this is an opportunity for you to be joined with someone where you've previously been in isolation. You've been on the side of the road, so to speak, feeling half dead. And here's an opportunity for a brother, for a sister, for a friend to come alongside and say, I'm with you, and I'm not going anywhere. An opportunity to share what's going on inside of our hearts. So if you're in need today, we can share, we can join, we can stop for one another. But also, when we think of those people, perhaps in our family, perhaps people in our workplaces or in our schools, just people that are coming to mind as I've been sharing, we can stop, we can join, and we can share while praying for them right now as well. We can turn to one another in this moment, even where we're seated or where we're standing, and we can actually pray for those people. That's how we're told, actually, through Scripture, that things really change and where things really begin. When we hold one another together, when we pray for one another, when we stop, when we join, and when we share. So I want to, first of all, just alert our prayer team and ask you to come to the front when we begin to sing, to be available for people who might want to be prayed with. But I also want to encourage you, wherever you are, wherever you're seated or you're standing, that if there's someone that you feel that you want to express the neighborliness of Jesus toward, this is a space to do that and to begin to do that, not in some grand gesture, not in some way that somehow is going to change their circumstances at just a flick of a switch, but just in the subtlety and the simplicity of prayer. Could we begin to pray for other people, the people that we are carrying in here today? And could we begin to pray for one another? I'm going to encourage you to stand if you'd like to. I'm going to invite our prayer team to come to the front. And we're going to spend the next few moments, just before Dave closes, stopping, joining, and sharing with one another.